As our new president, Phil, said, I just returned from a long trip through Indonesia, through the islands, and last night in Singapore. And it's no holiday. I've been working my monk's butt off, giving talks all over the place. But one thing I was very proud of on this recent tour of Indonesia, I finally managed to be the cause of a major traffic jam in the city of Medan in North Sumatra. About 3,400 people came to my talk there, and so it really jammed up the traffic around the city. Hooray! I caused a traffic jam at last. And they also told me that they had to issue tickets for that talk because they only had 3,400 places in the hall. And the tickets, they all sort of sold out in 8 hours. Lady Gaga came earlier, and it's a couple of days before her ticket sold out. So I beat Lady Gaga! That's what they announced. So it's a very sort of busy, but it's very strange as a monk if you have to face an audience of 3,400 or 5,000 people in Jakarta, where you're treated as a rock star, as a celebrity. And I really mean that because I have 3 books now in Indonesia which are legitimate bestsellers and go on the radio and the TV in Indonesia. But the worst part of that is that you have to work very hard and you don't get any peace. People are always wanting to take photographs and have sort of their book signed. I was told that in central Java, the great Buddhist monument of Borobudur, many of you may have been there, this beautiful ancient monument, World Heritage in the center of Java, so many people are taking photographs of that monument, the flashes are actually eroding the stone. And I was telling people, stop taking so many photographs of me, you're eroding me. And it gets to things like that, because I'm going to go on to the meaning of this, these stories in a few moments. That last month, when I was in Hong Kong, there's a couple of people from Hong Kong are here this evening, and I was just finished giving a talk in the Jockey Club, and again, lots of questions. And just like here, after a couple of hours talking, you may get quite tired. But more than that, I had to go to the toilet. Even monks have to go to toilets. And so I managed eventually to escape. So look, I really need to go to the toilet. So I went into the toilet, one of these big toilets with many cubicles and wash basins. And there was one of the men there had got there beforehand, and they said, "Oh, Ajahn Brahm, can I take your photo, please?" Even in the men's toilets, you had your photograph, and I was crossing my legs, "Please do it quickly." But before he finished, somebody else came in. And of course, once one person starts, they all start. So now there's 2 things which you can do when you have your photograph taken in amongst men's toilets. You can either sort of resist and get negative and say, "Stop it, why me? I'm a monk, I'm not supposed to have my photograph. I'm over 60 years of age now, I'm no longer handsome." Or you can just enjoy it and have fun. Because one thing which I've learnt in my life is just you cannot control the life. Sometimes you try your very best. I really thought that being a Buddhist monk, you could have a nice, peaceful, easy life, just meditating in the forest, going into the deep caves, letting go of the whole world and just being still and being peaceful. And here I am getting my photograph taken and going on TV and having, yes, I must admit it, makeup put on again. You have to do makeup before you go on TV. But anyhow, I always remember a story from my teacher, Ajahn Chah, which is, these little stories is one-line sayings they make such a change in the attitude you have to your life. So you stop controlling the life and say, no, I don't want my photograph taken. I don't want to be famous. I don't want to talk to so many people. I want to be simple. Instead of complaining, this story teaches you just how to go with the flow. It was the story of being a very young monk in Thailand in these forest monasteries, which were in just the last remnants of real jungle as the paddy fields encroached. So it was the last remnants of jungle, and this place where I was staying at was also a cremation ground, so the villagers were a bit scared of actually encroaching. They were so afraid of the ghosts. As a monk, I loved those ghosts because the ghosts kept all the people away so I could have some solitude and peace. So next to that monastery, maybe a kilometre and a half away, was the nearest village. And this was a time, there was no electricity in these villages, but there were generators, which they could hire when they wanted to have a party. And when they had a party, my goodness, they had a party. It went on usually for 3 days. So they all got drunk and messed around, and then they fell asleep. And when they woke up, they just started up from where they left off. So it did actually go for 3 days usually before they finished and got back to work again. And they started getting these generators with these huge amplifiers and speakers. So the sound was so loud, and they go on till about 2 o'clock in the morning, which would be fine if you could sleep in the next day. But in these monasteries, we would have to get up at 3 a.m. That's when the bell would sound, and we have to go up for our morning chanting and meditation. So we're only getting 1 hour sleep a night. Okay, you can do that for one or two nights, but after 3 nights, it gets really, really, you feel terrible. So we had to ask, you know, the first night, you know, when we realized there's a party going on, we asked the headman of the village, can you please stop at 12 o'clock, at 1 o'clock in the morning? At least give us a couple of hours sleep, please. But the headman wouldn't listen to us. So we met together. Our next strategy was to go and see our master, Ajahn Chah. They were scared of him. So that if he told them to, you know, shut it up, they would. So we had a delegation. We went to see our teacher, Ajahn Chah. And he said, look, it's so loud and noisy. We can't sleep. Our meditation, we're falling asleep in the morning. We're, you know, not really doing anything properly. And that's when he gave this wonderful one line, which I will never forget, and which you apply to so many other things in your life. He said, it's not the sound that disturbs you. It's you who disturb the sound. And that was so profound that it changed much of the way you looked at your life. If there is noise, it's the nature of life to be noisy. The villagers have to have their party. The rest of the time they're okay. So don't try and disturb the noise. Because it's not the noise which disturbs you. It's you who disturbs the noise. So the dog barks. What would you expect of dogs? They bark. Or your wife nags. Nag, 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 nag. It's not the wife disturbing you. You're disturbed. You disturb the nature of wifedom. That's what wives are like. That's what husbands are like as well. And that's why, like being a monk, that's what it's like. So when people want to take somebody photographs of you and sign books and give you all this ridiculous attention, you say, I'm not going to disturb this. And then it doesn't disturb me. And so much of life, especially the problems of life, can be solved if you understand the meaning of that statement and you extend it. It's not that the government disturbs you. You disturb the government. What do you think governments are like? All over the world they're pretty much the same. We've got a pretty good one here in Australia, no matter what sort of type of politics you have. You know, it's not that bad. You know, it's not like North Korea or Iran or some dictatorship, although sometimes reading the newspapers you think it's just as bad. But our problem in life is we want to disturb and control our life, when really we just can't do that. And instead, we learn to flow with things, just to let it be, not to fight so much. And if we can do that much, we find that so many of the negative reactions we have to life, always trying to disturb life. It's not that life disturbs you, it's you disturb life. I gave a simile while I was over in Indonesia of the exam. Because I was a school teacher before I became a monk for 1 year. And as I've told you before, that was one of the main reasons I became a monk. Teaching teenagers would make anybody want to leave the world. So anyway, I was a school teacher, but I had to set an examination for the children. And I wanted some advice. So I went up to a senior teacher and I asked him, how do you set an exam? Give me some advice. And he said, try and set the sort of the average mark to be about 70%. Because if the average mark is about 30 or 40%, the test is too hard and it will discourage your students. They think they can't do math, so they're hopeless, they're useless, so they won't actually put forth any effort and try the next time. And if you make it that everyone gets 95 or 100%, it's just too easy. And that doesn't work. Try and set it so it's 70%. Which means that they all get encouraged. Yes, they can do that subject. Yes, they're able. They get motivated. But the 30% where they make mistakes, that will teach me, that will give me feedback as their teacher. So in the next lesson, I can address those places which they didn't understand, where they made their mistakes. So the 30% will give me feedback as their teacher, so I could teach. The 30% is where they would grow. And that I extended to the meaning of life. The meaning of life is it's only 70% success, getting it right. 30% you make mistakes. And that is beautiful. Don't disturb that nature of life. If you try and disturb that nature of life and say, I don't want to keep making mistakes, you don't understand that mistakes are where we grow, where we learn. And if we always get it 100%, what's the meaning of life? We never learn anything. Just life is too easy. So that's when things do go wrong, when you do make mistakes, we don't disturb that beautiful truth of life. That is where we learn and grow from the difficulties and mistakes of life. So yeah, for me the last couple of weeks have been physically very, very tough and tiring. Not getting much sleep and travelling. I don't know, must have been out 14 or 15 flights in the last couple of weeks, which is very, very tiring. I often tell people when they ask me where I live, do you live in Perth? I say, no, I don't live in Perth, I live on aircraft. But when we learn the meaning of that, not to disturb the sound, we realize also that we don't disturb the fact that we make mistakes sometimes, the difficulties and problems. We accept and embrace and learn and grow from them. You've all heard me say the simile of the dog poo. If you haven't heard that before, here it comes again. The simile of the dog poo, there's many similes of dog poo. Actually, I'm in Australia now, I don't have to say poo anymore, I can say shit. Because you've got to be very careful which country you're in. So the simile of the dog shit is you go home from here, you tread in the dog shit. What should you do when you tread in dog shit? You don't scrape it off your shoes. That's what most people do. They're stupid. Why just instead you take it home with you? And you only scrape it off when you get into your garden. You scrape it off under the apple tree, the mango tree, under your rose bushes. I don't know what you're growing in your garden. You scrape it off there. And it means that 1 year later, your apple tree or your mango tree is going to be sweeter and juicier than before. And that's very true. So once you've dug the dog shit under your apple tree, and 1 year later you taste that apple, the most important part is you always remember what you're really eating. Please remember that it's dog shit, but it's been transformed into juicy apple. What we mean there is those 30% where you have difficulty in life, the troubles and the problems in life, if you know how to dig that in, you become wiser, compassionate, much kinder. You understand why we have dog shit on the footpaths, why we have to endure these things. And we don't disturb that. We accept and allow that these painful, difficult things happen, and we learn and we grow from them. And what do we learn and what do we grow? We grow just this wisdom and compassion, which is the meaning of life. So we can be wiser and kinder in this world, more beautiful people. That's why I know I outsold Lady Gaga in Medan, because she can sing, but I can show some wisdom and compassion to people. For example, I was reminded of a story I haven't told for such a long time. I couldn't remember the ending. I had to ask people, what was that? And it was just showing the importance of caring. And I love telling it in stories, because if you give a lecture anywhere, the thing which you walk away with, which you remember, are two things, the jokes and the stories. And the stories is a way of conveying wisdom in such a way that you will remember it. So this was actually the story of the mouse, the chicken, the pig and the cow. Because I was in Indonesia and many Muslims were coming to my talks, I changed it from the pig to the goat. Cultural sensitivities. You know, even that book which I wrote, the first book, Open the Door of Your Heart, there was a translation being done into Hebrew, and on the story, you know, of the difference between bacon and eggs, they said we can't actually use that in sort of Israel because it's, you know, bacon and pig. And if you don't know that story, that's what I usually tell when people get married. Now, that story is when people are getting married, I say, look, before you're married, you know, you're just involved. You know, you're going out together, even engaged. That's just called involvement. But once you're married, that's called commitment. And to make it very clear what we mean, I say the difference between involvement and commitment is the same as the difference between bacon and eggs. Do you understand? Because in bacon and eggs, think about it. The chicken is only involved. The pig is committed. You understand? The pig gives its whole life. Chicken only gives one egg. That's what commitment means. You give everything. They couldn't use that story in Israel because, you know, pigs, you're not supposed to talk about pigs, eat them and do all sorts of things with pigs in the Jewish tradition. But anyway, going back to the story of the the real story about the mouse, the chicken and the pig and the cow. It just shows you an important lesson in life, because these four were great friends, and they sit around having cups of coffee together and talking just like you guys do. But no, mice don't really drink coffee, but yeah, I usually embellish the stories to make them a bit more interesting. So they're having coffee one day, and they noticed the mouse was very, very agitated. "What's wrong, Mr. Mouse? Why are you so upset?" And he said, "It's because today I saw the farmer's wife," because they lived in a farm, "I saw the farmer's wife receive a parcel from the post, and when she opened it, I almost had a heart attack when I saw what was inside. A mouse trap. The farmer's wife has got a mouse trap, and I'm the only mouse in the house. It must be meant for me. She's trying to kill me." And the mouse was so upset, he turned to his best friend, the chicken, and said, "Chicken, can you please help me?" And the chicken said, "None of my business. You know, a mouse trap catches mice, not chickens. Now look after yourself. I don't know how to help you. And the chicken never helped the mouse because it thought that it wouldn't be affected by the mouse trap. And then the mouse asked the pig, "Pig, can you help me? I'm really scared because, you know, she leaves this mousetrap all over the place. I run backwards and forwards. It's only a matter of time before I step in it and kill myself. Can you help me?" And the pig said, "No, look after yourself. None of my business. Pigs don't have anything to do with mousetraps. I'm not going to help you." Because even the pig thought, you know, how can a mousetrap sort of do anything to a pig? And then lastly, he asked Mrs. Cow, "Mrs. Cow, can you help me?" You know what Mrs. Cow said? "Moo." "I can't help you. You know, look after yourself. It's your business. None of my business. I'm too busy munching grass and doing other cow things. I can't help you." So none of the mouse's friends would help, because they all thought that a mouse trap can't kill a pig, can't kill a chicken, can't kill a cow. But be careful, because when your friend asks for help, never think that, "Oh, it doesn't affect me," because it does. Because what happened? One night, the mouse was scurrying around and it got caught in the mouse trap. It was a night time. The mouse couldn't see. And as soon as it stepped on the mouse trap, did that make a good sound? As soon as it did on the mouse trap, it certainly hurt my hand. As soon as it stepped on the mouse trap, the mouse was killed. And because it made a noise, the farmer's wife woke up and she went downstairs to see if she'd caught the mouse. And because she was half asleep and because it was very dark, she didn't see the snake in the house. She trod on the snake and got bitten. And she called for her husband to help. And she was badly bitten. They called the doctor. The doctor did whatever they could. But she was very, very sick. And what do you do when you get sick? One of the best remedies for sickness is chicken soup. So you know what happened? The farmer got hold of the chicken, you know, cut off its head and made chicken soup. And it was, you know, stabilizing, but she was still very sick. And so what happens when you get sick? Your friends come to visit. And because so many friends came to visit, the farmer had to give them something to eat. So that was the end of the pig. The pig got killed so as to make pork sandwiches for the visitors coming to see his wife, who was who was bitten by the snake. But unfortunately, even with all the chicken soup, the farmer's wife got so sick she eventually died. And of course, you know, you've been to funeral services, I've been to funeral services. What happens after the funeral service? You feed the relations. So the only thing they could do was to kill the cow to feed the relations. So because of one mouse trap, it didn't just kill the mouse, it killed the chicken, the pig and the cow as well. And the meaning of that story: when your friend is in trouble and needs your help, don't think, "Oh, it doesn't affect me. None of my business. Look after yourself. Be careful." Because a mouse trap could even kill a cow. So if they want some help, please help them. Otherwise, you may regret it in the future. So these stories and these actually lessons in life, they actually teach us something, just the importance of caring, acceptance and wisdom. So in all the difficulties which you may have in life, please tell your friends and see if they can help. And as for you, sometimes we just have to endure. 70% is the best we can do. And we will make mistakes sometimes. We will be in great difficulty sometimes. But again, that's part of life. And if we can accept that that's part of life, embrace it. It's amazing what you can do. Again, over in Indonesia, I was extending that story of when I was a school teacher to mention that time when one of the children in my class of 30 came bottom of the class. If any school teachers here, you know that at the end of the year, you have to give out these report cards. So I had to give out these report cards, and they all opened their reports, and this one poor boy discovered he'd come bottom of the class, 30th, in a class of 30. Now, of course, someone has to come 30th, even a class of Einsteins, and you know, one Einstein has to come bottom. But if you've ever had that experience of failing, of coming bottom, what does it do to you? He just put his head down, and I could see from his body language he was depressed, but also afraid. Because that evening he'd have to show his parents that he'd come bottom of the class. And he could imagine the scolding he would get from his parents. And all the punishments or restrictions, you can't go out, you can't play on your computer, you can't do this and can't do that because you come bottom of the class. They're ashamed. Now, even when I was a school teacher, I was a Buddhist. You know that even I had to take the morning assembly, they called it, and it was supposed to have a religious flavour, but the principal, the headmaster, at least he was wise enough, he knew I was a Buddhist, he actually let me teach meditation for 5 mornings, Monday to Friday, to this high school in Devon, UK, to 650 children. And I'll never forget that experience, because there I was, this young teacher. And I said, I'm now going to teach you meditation. Sit down, put your right hand over your left hand, back straight, close your eyes and watch your breath. You know, everybody did it. 650 children in school in the morning sat quietly for 5 minutes. Because I remember afterwards, one of the teachers, a senior teacher, said, what would you have done if one of the children had started laughing? And only then did I start sweating. I never thought that would happen. Because, you know, if one kid had started laughing, the whole school would have burst out laughing and I'd have been totally embarrassed and as a school teacher demolished in my authority. But it's amazing, when you believe in what you're doing and you don't fear failure, it's amazing just how positive and how successful you can be. You know those children, after 5 minutes of meditation, this was in 1973, they gave me an ovation. They all started clapping. It's amazing that they really, even though it's only 5 minutes, and these were 11-year-olds to 18-year-olds, they realised this was really important, what a wonderful thing that was. I always remember that. And anyway, back to the end of the year when I had to give out the report cards. This one kid came 30th. They all knew I was a Buddhist, so I went up to the kid and I said, look, I'm going to teach you some Buddhism. And I'm going to teach you this idea in Buddhism of the Bodhisattva. Now, some of you know some Buddhism. Some people know lots of Buddhism. Some people who come here know no Buddhism at all. But you may have heard the word Bodhisattva in Buddhism. It's a being who's very highly respected. And even many people worship this Bodhisattva. Because a Bodhisattva is a person, man or woman, who sacrifices everything for other people, who never thinks of themselves, but only thinks of other people's happiness and well-being. And I told this young boy, I said, I know you are Bodhisattva. You've intentionally, deliberately taken this rotten position of bottom of the class, so none of your friends have to suffer what you're going to get from your parents tonight. You haven't thought of yourself like all your other friends think of themselves. They're all selfish. You decided to sacrifice yourself to take this terrible position of bottom of the class so no one else has to suffer. You are Bodhisattva. And I said to him, I'm going to recommend to the headmaster that you get the school Bodhisattva prize this time. Okay. Bottom of the class, you can even see something positive in that. But I did tell the kid, he said, but you're only allowed to get Bodhisattva prize once in your school year. Next year, let one of your friends take that position, not you. But what he was actually teaching is even when you think it's big time failure, bottom of the class, there's still a way you can look upon that with a positive attitude. The dog shit for your mango tree or apple tree. There's always one way you can actually embrace it and make use of it and grow from it in your life, which is what my teacher's advice, don't disturb life. It's not life disturbs you. It's just the way you react and look at the difficulties and problems in life. You can always make something out of it. Just the same when somebody's mobile phone goes off. It always happens because that's the nature of mobile phones. They go off. And even though you're sure you put it into silent mode, it happens. But... so don't disturb the mobile phone. It's not the mobile phone which disturbs you. Embrace it as part of life. The trouble is that how many people get embarrassed when that happens? Now that's the problem. Not the mobile phone going off, but getting embarrassed when it happens. In other words, we live in a society where we're not allowed to make mistakes. Where we always expect 100%, not 70%. And wouldn't it be a wonderful world if you're allowed to make mistakes? Wouldn't it be a wonderful place where you don't have to be perfect? That means not disturbing life, allowing yourself to be imperfect, because so 30% of time when you make mistakes, that is the growing pain of life. That is the learning edge. That is where we actually grow and actually make progress in life, in the mistakes of life. Now imagine if we all embrace that as part of life, not life going wrong, not some big cosmic mistake, but an essential part of life. It doesn't have to be perfect, and people could make mistakes. Oh, how freeing that feels. At work, if you can make a mistake. At home with your partner, that you're allowed to make mistakes. In life, that life allows mistakes to happen. Wouldn't that be wonderful? You feel such a great sense of freedom. And a lack of the tension, the tightness of always having to be perfect. And when you make a mistake, lying about it or hiding it and not admitting it, that you made a mistake. And that is actually why people get a lot of stress in their life. Because they're not allowed to be imperfect. Remember, another teacher once told me, he's walking in the jungles or forests of Thailand, he said, look at the forests, look at the jungles. There's not one tree which is perfectly straight, you know, with all its branches coming out evenly, you know, with no growth on the trunks, you know, with all the leaves nice and green and fresh. There is no such thing as a perfect tree. Look at the forest. Those trees are all over the place, leaning this way and leaning that way, with vines on them, with branches hanging off. That's why nature is beautiful. If ever you want to see trees perfect, all in lines and rows, go to a forest planted by the government. Do you like to go to such plantations? Does that give you the same sense of beauty and peace that a natural forest gives you? My understanding from that simile, that the beauty of a forest includes all the trees which are dying, which are dead, which are deformed, which are leaning this way and leaning that way. That gives the forest beauty. And he was telling me, and I'm telling you now, that's what gives you beauty. You're all deformed in one way or another. Getting old, broken teeth. Maybe you try and hide all of that, but you know, it's there, isn't it? None of you are perfect specimens of humanity. But what it does mean, actually, that on one of the talks I gave in Jakarta, just one of my fans in Jakarta now, he was the world champion bodybuilder. And actually, I saw his picture on a bus afterwards in Jakarta advertising some sort of vitamin supplement. This huge guy, I forget what his name is now, but, you know, he's quite famous in Indonesia. This huge guy came on, really, really strong, like muscles like Arnie Schwarzenegger. And now he's a disciple of mine, so be careful, any of you who criticise me. I just have to now to tell my friend that, you know, you'll get wasted very quickly. No, we don't do things like that. That's only a joke. But he did shake my hand and my poor hand afterwards. But there's no such thing as a perfect person, a perfect being. And isn't it wonderful you don't have to be perfect? You know, it's such a lot of stress. I don't know, in your relationships, the partner you live with, does your partner expect you to be perfect? If they do, what sort of relationship is that? Don't you feel that stress and the tightness, always having to live up to unachievable goals? So I tell people in life, if you want to be happy and peaceful in life, lower your expectations. Lower your expectations to the 70% mark of life. Because if we have expectations of 80, 90, 100%, you expect your wife to be 90%, your husband to be, you know, 85% at least. That's where you have marital trouble. If you expect your kid to be that perfect, that's where the kid feels so much pressure that they can't just be themselves. And that causes the stress of life where people get sick, upset, and psychologically damaged. So please, lower the expectations of your children, lower the expectations of your husband, of your wife, and especially of yourself. Then you can be happy at last. I don't have to be 100%. 70% is good enough. 70% of in a forest. Beautiful trees, it's nature. That's why what we learn by not disturbing life, what that really means is loving life, opening the door of your heart to life as it is, instead of expecting it to be so damn perfect. Don't expect your monks to be so perfect, your nuns to be so perfect, and please don't expect your new committee to be so perfect. They try their hardest, they'll make mistakes. That happens in life, and it's good fun. I really enjoy it. Last night, I gave a talk in Singapore. The hall was only supposed to take 600 people, and 1,200 people came in. And that was actually really good fun. It all went wrong, and the organisers, they couldn't do anything. They kept on streaming in. And it's really nice atmosphere with people sitting all over the place and standing up. That was a really nice talk because everything went wrong. Oh, what is it again? That my favourite funerals. Have you been to many funerals. You know that when everything goes according to clockwork and everything is so-called perfect, that's so boring. Maybe it's because I've been to too many funerals. I get bored when everything goes right. When something goes wrong, that really is interesting. I mean, my classic wrong funeral, well, actually there's been quite a few of them. I remember this one funeral I was doing. It was a burial, and it was a Chinese fellow, and there's many Chinese Malaysians or Singaporeans. They did the very best for their father, as they always do. But their problem was they put so many of these little knobs and gadgets on the outside of the coffin, you know, and the big handles, very ornate. It looked really amazing, like some king was being sort of buried. Mm-hmm. But when they lowered it into the hole, it got stuck halfway down. Too many handles and knobs. And those poor funeral directors, they couldn't lower it any further. It was only halfway down. And they couldn't pull it up either. It was stuck. Oh, that was memorable. I really loved that one. Funeral directors didn't. But the best one, it was, you know, it's Jenny. She usually sits at the front over here on a Friday night. She's not here. But when her partner died, Steve, I don't know if you know this, in Australia,
you can make your own coffins. You don't have to buy one from the shelf. You can actually personalize them. And this guy, he had a white water rafting company before. So they made it in the shape of a canoe with two paddles on top. It's personal, you know, it has more meaning. That's allowable to do that. You know, you've got some certain restrictions, you know, some sizes you have to make it are not too big. But you can make your own coffins. And the problem was they made it out of jarrah, really thick jarrah, which is incredibly heavy. So when they put it on the little conveyor, you know, where it goes behind the little screen, this was in the Fremantle, there was the open funeral place there, and they put it on there, and that poor conveyor belt had such a trouble moving it. It was really struggling because it was so heavy. So it went halfway through when the screen came back and it jammed halfway. And I mean, it really did jam. The funeral directors couldn't move it. It wasn't in, it wasn't out. Now, what did Jenny do? She, you know, very, you know, kind, trying to help. She got up on top of the conveyor belt and tried to push. And her friend said, "Do you really want to get rid of your husband that much?" And that just started it. You know, when one person tells something and people start laughing, the whole lot were laughing. Somebody said, "Yeah, Steve, I know he's his best friend and went to school together. The first day he got his first car, he crashed that too. First day in the coffin, he crashes his coffin." Typical Steve. And it really was, from that moment on, celebration of a life. That was a beautiful funeral. Eventually they managed to jemmy the screen over and push him through. So he wasn't stuck there forever. All the time, I'm going over time now, just last little quote. There was a time when every year, I did this about 2 or 3 weeks ago, we have this interfaith service at St. George's Cathedral, you know, in town. And you get, you know, all the sort of the usual suspects, you know, the rabbi, you know, the imam, the Buddhist monk is me, you know, and some monsignor and, you know, the dean of St. George's Cathedral. We do an interfaith service for Commonwealth Day. Always the same, and actually it's pretty boring, but this one day, it was many years ago, some crazy guy rang the police and said, "No, it's not right, it's desecrating a Christian church to have all these unbelievers from other faiths inside the sacred area." And so they said they'd planted a bomb in St. George's Cathedral. And so in the middle of the service, now I saw the policeman come in and talk to the dean, John Shepherd. And John Shepherd came to the microphone and said, "We've got to stop right now. There's a bomb in the cathedral. We all have to go out." That was the best Christian service I've ever been to. Wow, everybody woke up. And we all went out to have a cup of tea while we were waiting for the police to, you know, see if there was a real bomb in there or not. And we started talking together and laughing and cracking jokes together. And that was the best interfaith service I've ever been to. And I actually told the dean, I said, "Well done, at last you know how to organise a good interfaith. Can we please do this every year?" Because it's when things go wrong like that, isn't that human? Isn't that brings you back to real life? This is not, life is not some organized event, you know, run like the London Olympics. Life is what goes wrong. And in life, when it goes wrong, we can laugh. And why do we laugh at those stories? Because you can recognize that that's part of your life. That's part of everybody's life. No tree in the forest is perfect. And that's why it's beautiful. None of your life will be perfect. You'll never get 100%. Never expect your partner to be 100%. Give them a break, and then you give yourself a break as well. And you can be at peace with yourself, you can be at peace with life at last. If you want life to be 100%, your kids to be 100%, your wife to be 100%, you're going to be very frustrated in life. If you want just there to be no sound, at least not when you're meditating or when you want to go to sleep, you're going to be so angry at life. So remember, don't disturb the sound, and then the sound doesn't disturb you. Don't disturb the nature of life, and life won't disturb you. So when I go out and overseas and treat it like some celebrity, instead of disturbing that, I enjoy it, have fun with it. And then when I come home, I'm back down to normal again. Go back to monastery and having to clean the toilets. And I enjoy that too. So that's what we mean. But it's not life disturbs you. It's you who disturbs life. If you understand the meaning of that, you can have a very peaceful, happy life. Thank you for listening.